Episode 2, Your Real Why. Hear that? Me neither. That's the sound of no intro music and no intro voiceover. It's the sound of a podcast starting in a different way. So what's a podcast intro for? Well, in part, they provide a clear delineation between the start and finish of episodes. They give people a place to stick their ads or to ask for reviews, which of course 99% of people ignore anyway. They provide a degree of polished professionalism. You know, they signal to people, hey, this podcast is legit. There's music and an intro, like a real show. But primarily, the reason behind the intro is for that first-time listener. It tells that first-time listener what the show is about. Except, once you've heard the intro as a listener, chances are you don't need to hear it again. Chances are you fast-forward through it, unless your hands are covered in raw chicken because you're in the middle of cooking dinner. And so you find yourself a little annoyed because you're going to have to listen to that same royalty-free track and voiceover for the umpteenth time. Now, what's interesting is that most listeners of any given podcast episode are returning listeners. So everyone is subjected to something on account of that small minority of new people. New people spoil it for everyone else. Not here, though, new listener, because as you notice by now, no intro. So you're welcome here. So what's the point of this whole line of questioning? It is not, I will tell you, to criticize the practice of including a standard intro to a podcast. In case I'm not televising it enough, I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek, but I'd like to explain what all this seeming nonsense is about with a story that I believe better illustrates the real heart of the matter. Story's about a guy named Nick, really smart guy, graduated from Colgate with his degree in philosophy, but as you may have noticed, not many people these days become philosophers, so like many philosophy majors, in fact, he ended up in finance. Got a job as a trader on the floor of the Merck, Chicago Mercantile Exchange. He was a natural. He was someone who just had this incredible mental agility, has incredible mental agility, and he honed that day in and day out, became quite successful as an investor. Well, his life took a pretty interesting turn after a lunch at a restaurant called Trio. His friends set up the lunch, and it was there that he met the chef, a guy named Grant. Nick and Grant had a great conversation, ended up connecting a few more times. And a little while later, Nick's wife's birthday rolled around, and she wanted to go back to that restaurant. Now, Nick had gotten to know Grant a little bit, and so he shot him an email asking if he could bring his wife for her birthday dinner. And then he included something in the email that bordered on taunting. He ended the email saying, hey, just so you know, my wife's ethnically Latvian, speaks Japanese, and loves Thai food. Good effing luck. And I say taunting because he knew exactly what this would do to a guy like Grant. That Grant would then spend the next 2 weeks of his life researching Latvian food and he'd redo an entire menu. That's just how Grant was. So birthday night rolls around and Grant proceeds to serve them a 20-course meal, blowing Nick and his wife away. When they're finished, Grant asks them what they thought of the meal. And Nick says to Grant, I don't think anybody anywhere in the world had a better meal than this tonight. And Grant says, well, thank you. Nick says, what do you plan to do with yourself? Grant says, well, what do you mean? And Nick says, well, you're not going to be here forever. And Grant says, someday I'd like to build my own restaurant. And Nick, a man with absolutely no restaurant experience whatsoever, replies, I'd be happy to help you do that. A week later, Grant comes over to his house. They discuss. And they, on that night, agree to become business partners. So a year later to the day, after that decision to become business partners, barely knowing each other beyond a handful of interactions, these two guys opened a restaurant called Alinea, which is now an insanely successful 3-Michelin-star restaurant, Chicago's only one. If you listen to Nick and Grant talk about designing this restaurant experience, you see an interesting thread. For starters, you walk in, there's no podium with hosts behind it. There are no white tablecloths. In fact, the entire experience feels incredibly different from most restaurants, and there's a reason for this. They wanted to design an experience that created emotional responses from the moment you walked in the front door. So they asked themselves these incredibly basic questions, like, what does a good greeting look like? Well, if you're at someone's house, what does that feel like? If you're at a restaurant, what shouldn't it feel like? Well, probably shouldn't feel like someone standing behind a computer and asking you, what's your name? How about candles? Should we have them? Good question, but probably not a good first question. Why do restaurants use candles in the first place? Okay, some say candles are romantic. They provide ambiance. Well, why are candles romantic? Why do fancy restaurants have white tablecloths? Turns out, it's because the table underneath is a piece of crap. And so on and on it went, asking themselves, why is that? Why does it work that way? Knowing that it's the people who are most entrenched in a given industry or a given system that tend to have no clue why something is the way it is. And so they don't even wonder, is there a better way? Now, have you ever been blown away by a young child during that age when they ask why about everything? I mean, a kid in this phase can literally bring a rocket scientist to their knees, to the very edge of their understanding of physics itself, just by asking why enough times. Yet somewhere along the way, we stop asking ourselves this question so much. And that's not just a death of a kind of innocence. It's actually the death of a kind of curiosity. Now, I think the real problem when we stop asking ourselves this question is that we're missing the opportunity to turn its penetrating lens back around on ourselves, our choices, on why we're doing things that we're doing. I've had the opportunity over the years to engage in this level of inquiry with other people. Sometimes it's coaching individuals. Sometimes it's been working with teams, not to mention the times that I get to do this with friends or other moments outside the professional domain. And I would have to say it is one of my favorite things to be a part of, this excavation process, because so often it is a catalyst for really good things to come. It's the root of beneficial transformation on many different levels. And it's never as straightforward as we think it's going to be. Why is our team always stretched so thin? Why does our team do things this particular way? Why can't we seem to get more focused and narrow our priorities? Why aren't we getting the results we expected? Or as individuals, why haven't I been promoted? Why am I dissatisfied? Why am I a manager when my real passion is doing the coding? Why are my energy levels low? Why am I doing what I'm doing for work? In coaching and consulting, there's this concept of the presenting agenda. Like, say a leader wants to do a project or a workshop with their team, and they come in and they have this very specific request. We need a new executive prioritization and planning process. Okay, why is that? We're pulled in too many directions. The organization keeps changing our priorities. All right, why is that? And what you find is that the presenting agenda of a prioritization process in this case is really a band-aid for a deeper set of issues. I like to work with individuals and teams on issues of stress and overload. I think of it a little bit as like a sweet spot. I'm just like drawn to trying to solve that issue. And so someone will say, I'm stressed. I'll say just like that, I'm stressed. And I'll say, why are you stressed? Well, of course, I'll say it just like that too. And they'll say, because I'm too busy. I'm too overloaded. And so there's the diagnosis of the problem right there. That gets formulated into the presenting agenda. I'm stressed because I'm overloaded. So it seems. So years ago, I was in a leadership role in product management during a really challenging time for a company, and I inherited this strategy that I did not believe in. I was actually much more extreme than that. I believed it would slowly run the company into the ground. And then a leadership change at the top happened, and there was this brief window of time where there was openness to significant strategic change. But the leader was new, didn't know the industry, didn't know what or who to believe. But my team and I were granted this opportunity to pitch a new direction. And so for the next 6 weeks, we charged down this path of creating a completely new direction, fit with all the data and analysis to back up our assertions. And I'll tell you, those 6 weeks were the grind of a lifetime. We worked from morning until deep into the night. We ate all our meals in the office. We came in on weekends. We would rotate who would take a night off and make sure others could step in and cover. It was like someone always had to stay awake by the campfire to keep watch and make sure the fire didn't burn out. And it's years later now, and I've stayed in touch with many people from that team. And I've heard many times from those people how when they look back on that little stretch of time, they look back on it as one of the best experiences of their careers. So that's strange, isn't it? Because you would think if too much work was inherently problematic, we should have been the most miserable people ever. But it was the opposite. So why is that? I've often reflected on this, and here's some of what I came to. So to begin with, there was this sense of true connection and trust among our team. We felt like a team in the trenches together. You know, we were supporting each other. We had each other's back. And when we needed to tend to personal commitments, you know, one person had something come up, we covered for them. And when it was our turn to duck out and catch up on life, we knew everyone had our back. We cycled breaks. We made sure everyone got to take a breath when they were hitting their limits of exhaustion. Everyone mattered. Actually, go way further than that. Everyone was essential. We leaned on people's special talents and gifts. A little bit like Ocean's 11, you know, ragtag motley crew of people with their own unique idiosyncratic talents that were all essential puzzle pieces of pulling off this incredible heist. There was also a defined goal and endpoint. You know, it wasn't indefinite. You could always see the light at the end of the tunnel. And when we did hit the goal, there was an opportunity to celebrate the win and to exhale. We didn't do what so many teams or leaders do and just follow up one sprint with yet another and grind and create this endless hamster wheel effect that's the hallmark of what ails so much of corporate America. And most importantly, it mattered to us. There was a sense of real purpose. We cared about the outcome. This was something we could rally around. The work really mattered. It wasn't just so we make our bonus, or so we grow the top line 10%, or the usual generic, uninspiring corporate nonsense. This was about writing the course of the company itself. It was about turning things around and rescuing it from the jaws of defeat to where we stood a chance to be number one, because very few people can endure being on a losing team for such an extended stretch of time. So this was about getting things back to a place where we could believe in what we were doing again. In other words, there was a real why behind it. Uncover this why. Let it guide you to a fundamental, unshakable, lasting sense of well-being and fulfillment.